This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure for me to have in the studio right here with me Susan Eisenberg, a master electrician, a writer, a poet, a mixed media artist. She's done amazing work exploring the role of women in the trades. She's the author of the nonfiction book, We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction, and her poetry books include Pioneering, Poems from the Construction Site, and Blind Spot. Susan Eisenberg, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got interested in working in the trades.
I grew up in Cleveland, actually my grandfather had a hardware store, my dad's dad. Both my grandparents had, my grandfathers had worked in the trades, and my dad and all his brothers and sisters were born in the back of the hardware store in a little apartment. I think there was something about that was just felt familiar, and then I went to University of Michigan, and I came out to Boston, and in the mid-70s, there was just a lot of, energy around opening occupations to women, and I was doing a women's theater at the time and, you know, doing technical stuff with that, so it just, I don't know, it was just kind of following an interest.
But it's a bit of a departure to go from, you know, doing the lights at the theater to going onto the construction site.
Yes, it is. But it was sort of a way to, like, earn a good living and be able to do my own creative work on the side and not have to, be hustling grants. And so it just seemed like an easy fit. And I did a CETA program, Non-Traditional Occupations for Women, in 1977, and really liked the electrical work. And I actually, in December of that year, called the Electricians Union and talked to a guy who became a great ally later, but what he told me then was, the unions don't want you, the contractors don't want you, we'll call you if we need you. That's where the title of the book comes from. And then in April of 78, when the affirmative action guidelines came out, I got a call and started that fall.
I read in your books about this resistance even from within the unions. There was one really startling quote, we had the coloreds forced down our throats in the 1960s, and we'll be damned if we'll have the chicks forced down our throats in the 1970s. This is from a union person.
That
was kind of appalling. But so you had to bump your head against that continually at the beginning.
Yes, I don't think that's totally turned around either. Sadly, I think now it's not that hostility, but it's so directly. But there's just an erasure.
And how were you received initially?
Well, I think it's just a range of things. And the first company I worked for was really hostile and scary and really kind of a dangerous foreman who, you know, was trying to set me up to get hurt. But then I was really relieved to get laid off when I went to another company. And actually the foreman I was working for there had also worked for this same guy and hated him. So we became good buddies. So I think it was just a wide range of people who really went out of their way to take you under their wing sometimes because they saw that you were really earnest. You know, that was, I think, how my mode was to be really earnest, and I was here to work.
But there was a lot of testing of you. Can you do this? Can you do that? And then
in some ways, false testing of I remember working on at the Westin Hotel in Copley Place in Boston, and the foreman there had me run a bank of pipes on, you know, Unistrut, like hang Unistrut to run pipes on by myself. I had never done this before. I had no idea what that was, you know, how to do that. And, you know, so it was very public and I failed. I was an apprentice, second year apprentice. And then, you know, two journeymen went and did it fine. And it was a two-person job. He had me do it by myself. So, yeah, that was...
So he set you up for failure.
Yeah. Yeah, so there was a lot of that. And I think there's a lot of stories.
But there also must have been a lot of sexual harassment, too.
Yeah, Yeah, I think for me, the issues were much more about just fighting for the training, felt like the big issue, and fighting for that, you know, kind of those job opportunities. But certainly that's a lot of, you know, what derails a lot of women too, the sexual harassment issues of, you know, that sometimes then people start coming to work, you know, avoid work, then they have broken time, and, you know, that the reason for the broken time becomes invisible, and then they spin out.
You have a whole series of poems, Partner Number One, Partner Number Two, more than half a dozen of them about different people you had to work with. Do you mind reading one of these?
Yeah, no, and it was sort of fun is when I've been reading them other places, like I realized everybody had the same partners. So I'll read this one, sort of the old-timer poem, you know, the partner. Partner Number One. It was him and men like him refashioned that skyline. A remnant from more colorful days when everyone answered to a name like the Buzzard or Brownwater or Stinky or Dr. Doom. Days more difficult than these when the work was done all by hand and it was not so easy a girl could do it. More dangerous days when you saw men flatten like pancakes, fried like chickens, sailing like kites to their death, and no one came out to check on why. Reduced now to the easier tasks, save for old-timers and the partners no one else will accept. His eyesight, no match for tiny print on a motor nameplate. He growls and hisses and shoves a lifetime of lessons on any student willing. Gold, fool's gold, pebbles, bundled together in one sack.
So he couldn't do some of the work anymore because he was so old, but he could teach, right?
Yeah, he could teach and could really appreciate somebody who really, like, admired the craft. And I think that's what sort of won over some people, you know, that you really admired the craft and really were trying to learn it. So sometimes people really, you know, you were there, you know, kind of showing that how good they were by training you well.
And he ultimately appreciated teaching you?
Yeah, I think there were people like that, yeah. So there was kind of both sides. And I think what's really hard in construction is that it's all kind of contingent work. So you know, go on to a job, well, like at the Copley Place job, I was the fourth electrician on the job, but then it went up to like 60 people. And so, like, the job fluctuates, so you might have a great crew, but then, you know, this more people come in or people shift out or you get sent over somewhere else. So it's, you're kind of never make your way once. You're kind of always making your way again and again or proving yourself, you know, kind of go to a new job or a new company and you again have to prove yourself. So I think that's been really one of the real hardships that women have faced in that industry.
You're the new kid in school every semester or every year. I'm sitting with Susan Eisenberg. She is a master electrician, writer, poet, mixed media artist who's done chronicling of women in the construction trades. One of her books is called We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction. And she just read one of her poems from, was that from Pioneering?
Pioneering.
Pioneering poems from the construction site. You talk a lot about the women you started with. There was a group of six of you.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you all meet and how did you all start to decide just to plow into this field together?
Well, we just met because we were all accepted into the union. So I'm in the IB, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, since 1978. I'm a union member. So we were just the first six women that came into that class. One of the women actually, you know, had been in the CETA program that I had been in, and another woman I knew from, I did know before that. So there were six of us that started, and then at the end of the first year, well, one of the women who was really more isolated, she was the only one who was in class by herself. We worked 40 hours a week, and then we had class two nights a week. She was off in class by herself, and she didn't live near us and didn't carpool with us. Four of us carpooled together for 4 years was kind of how we made it. But she dropped out at the end of the first year, was kind of driven out, and I have a poem about her in my first chapbook, she's inspired some of my work. So when Zini was pushed out, we all kind of gathered in the bathroom because that would be the congregating place, the bathroom in the union's the apprenticeship training school. And we just said, you know, I think we really understood the idea of solidarity. Like, we could be pushed out one at a time. You know, she was sort of the most vulnerable, even though she was the best mechanic and really should have been the first one to make it. So we kind of really committed to like making sure each other would make it through, that we would make it through together. And, you know, even though we didn't like always like each other, get along, we kind of understood we were going to either, you know, picked off one at a time or make it through together. And we did, and the five of us were the first, you know, women to graduate in our local.
And when she didn't make it, were you worried that you weren't going to make it yourself?
Well, I really worried that I wouldn't make it myself. At the end of my third year, I had a really bad injury to my hands. I was on a running a hoist and sort of a resistive repetitive motion thing with a really hostile journeyman that I was working with, who would always make these kind of lewd remarks. And, you know, so it was like very stressful and repetitive motion, and I injured both my, you know, I had no motion in either wrist and was out of work for a while, and I thought I'd never go back. And, you know, people just said they'd come and drag me out. And the same thing, this apprenticeship director who had said, you know, we'll call you if we need you. You know, he just told me, like, I don't care what you do after it, you're going to finish this program. And he, you know, made sure. And he sent me out to a great job doing control work. Although it was an overtime job, so it was sort of crazy. I went, you know, kind of working overtime from thinking I couldn't work. But you know, Zini called me, like, the day we graduated, you know, and to just say, kind of congratulate me. And but also to kind of say she felt ashamed for having dropped out. And I really... I mean, that's part of what inspires some of the work I do, like the shame that a lot of women have felt for leaving, you know, for not making it when it really wasn't their fault, as, you know, that like the system failed them, you know, but people internalize that. So that really touched me.
And is the system still failing women in the construction trades?
Definitely. You know, women are still, you know, the idea of, you know, these non-traditional occupations, which is what they get called, is, you know, like sort of like pioneering. These are kind of supposed to be temporary terms. So the fact that we're still, you know, in 2011 calling, you know, construction for women a non-traditional occupation, you know, we've kind of don't think that way about, you know, women lawyers or women doctors. Women are still, you know, the idea was, you know, if you look at the federal guidelines of 78 to get to women to 25% of the workforce, you know, really years ago by now, they're still 2.5%. They've been locked into that.
2.5%.
Yeah, they've been, you know, roughly, it kind of goes up and down, but it's been between 2 and 3% since the early 80s. And, you know, good economic times, bad economic times, it kind of stays the same. So I think it's really, if you believe that women are capable of this work and qualified to do this work and enjoy it, you know, in a good environment, which is what I found for myself and talking to everybody else, you know, people around the country, then you have to say there's, you know, something really wrong here.
And what is that that's really wrong?
Well, I think we really still have yet to have really a commitment from, you know, contractors and unions to really say, you know, let's look at, you know, if you think of an occupation where it's been one gender for, you know, decades and decades and decades, you have to wonder, like, what's embedded in that culture and how the work is organized that's just part of what spins women out, as well as discrimination. So I think you have to have a real zero tolerance about you know, behavior that discriminates. And I think really bring women into the table and say, you know, kind of, I mean, the original guidelines were set up to have an oversight group to say, let's make this, you know, solve this and, you know, keep finding what's making it not work. And I think you really need to have that.
Is it a hostile workplace, and is it just that some of the workplaces are so small that it's hard to, you know, if you solve one, you've got all the other ones to solve?
There certainly are, you know, well, there's a case of a, you know, that got a lot of press of a woman line worker in Oregon who, you know, was, you know, had her journey card withheld, even though she, you know, performed, you know, really at the top of her, you know, kind of the top third of her class and all these things, and, you know, was physically, you know, hit on the job and sexually harassed. So, you know, and I really applaud her openness about that. But yes, we, you know, kind of see women being isolated. So I think we really have to address it nationally and really, you know, I think those of us who came in early on really saw a different, saw how it worked. You know, in early on, there was a lot of, you know, high visibility to recruit women, to, you know, bring women in, doing outreach, a lot of, you know, my own union, really local, felt like, you know, it was changing. So they had us help with recruitment to doing outreach to women. They really, you know, we revised the health welfare policies to, like, you know, fit women. We kind of did, we had a lot of, you know, we really were brought in to really think about how to change the workplace. And then, you know, once it was clear there was no government oversight anymore, you know, we kind of went from Carter to Reagan and no more monitoring. all that fell away.
I mean, it is horrifying that, you know, more than 30 years have gone by and you're still at 2.5% in the construction trades with women when it was supposed to be set at 25%.
Yeah. So it doesn't seem, I don't know anybody who thinks that's really a normal reflection of interest and ability. And I think especially, you know, if you think 2015 is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, and, you know, and all this stuff goes back to that. You know, when I grew up, it was help wanted male, female, you know, in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, you know, that was like how the want ads were, you know, and that became illegal in 65. And, you know, but we still really haven't unravel that legacy.
And this is probably the most segregated industry by sex in the country.
Well,
it's
I
hard
think
to
firefighters
think
aren't
firefighters
nationally aren't so different. Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, and we see like in the military, we see you know kind of all this issues of sexual harassment coming. You know, so you know, there's a lot of those. Yeah, but certainly construction is one of them is a major one, and firefighting really is as well.
My guest today is Susan Eisenberg. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Susan Eisenberg is the author of We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction. And she's an incredible poet, and a couple of her books include Pioneering, Poems from the Construction Site, and Blind Spot. I'd love it if you'd read Pioneering, which I think is a really neat poem and talks about a lot of the things we've been talking about over the last few minutes.
And let me say, I wrote this after I was out in California, did a reading, and I realized how my early poems about working in the trades were so positive. And a woman firefighter from there came up to me afterwards, and she kind of called me on that, and she said, you know, that she had left the firefighting, and if it had been so positive as I was sort of portraying it in my early poems, she would have stayed. And it, you know, made me be more honest. So so this poem comes from kind of getting called out. Pioneering. For the tradeswomen of 78, she had walked into their party uninvited, wedging a welcome mat in the doorway for other women she hoped would follow along soon. The loud ones argued to throw her out immediately. Even her supporters found her audacity annoying. But once they saw she mingled with everyone, drank American beer, kept conversations going during awkward silences, and was backed up by law, the controversy calmed. She surprised them. She was reliable. She always gave her best. She was invited back. She became a regular, always on the fringe, expected to help out just a little more. When she stopped coming, they were confused. Why now? Hadn't she challenged custom, stared down rumors, ingratiated herself years ago so that now her presence was only mildly discomforting? She never explained. After all those years hurling back cannonballs, womanizing the barricades, firing only if she saw the whites of their eyes, it was the lonesomeness of pioneering that broke her resistance. All those silences about what mattered most in her life had worn her, like the slow eating away of acid on metal, the damage only visible over time.
It's just such an intense line, the lonesomeness of pioneering that broke her resistance. Did you get your resistance broken?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, I left after about 15 years, and it was really just from feeling like I was, you know, I can remember this as just a first-year apprentice on my job, and I just felt like, you know, and he was making these lewd, racist comments and at coffee break, and I thought, like, why am I still in the same you know, when the numbers stay so low, you're kind of revisiting the same questions. You're not really in new challenges. And that just seems so discouraging. And, you know, I was at a Women in Non-Traditional Careers symposium yesterday in Piazza, Iowa, with sponsored by Dubuque Area Labor Council. And I saw there were a lot of women there who really, you know, were each one in a different, you know, one with the gas company, electric company, off on their own, and all very, you know, the same, you know, earnest and, you know, dealing with things head on and, you know, but, you know, after a while that just gets tiresome. So that's why I'm kind of into this idea of, you know, we got to move the decimal point from the 2.5% to 25% and really just, you know, get over this.
And to what extent were you just physically worn down? You talked about the wear and tear on that repetitive job you had. There's a poem in there where you talk about not being able to use either hand.
Yeah, so that was that injury.
Was that the same one? I wondered if you had bad carpal tunnel.
No, so I had to, it was actually de Quervain syndrome, which is the sheathing on your tendons. I did recover from that. So I felt really lucky about that. But no, it really wasn't. It was more just, I just got tired. You know, I didn't come into the industry thinking it would always be 2.5%. I kind of thought we were just the beginning of a big change, and it would be a, you know, and I just, it just got it worn.
And did you face much anti-Semitism or encounter much anti-Semitism on the workplace?
Well, not so much. You know, I actually had a partner who, you know, the day I was out, like, people made all these anti-Semitic comments. So he bought a Jewish star and necklace, and he wore it to work the next day and, you know, kind of leaned over so people would always see it. So
And he wasn't Jewish.
He wasn't Jewish.
So that was just solidarity.
Yeah, that was just solidarity. And actually another time, you know, I think I was maybe on that same job because I know I was with him. You know, somebody had making kind of sort of anti-Semitic comments about a Jewish contractors and stuff. And, you know, and then I just said, you know, I'm Jewish. And, you know, like, he goes like, well, that's okay. You know? And the same guy said, like, you know, he doesn't get it. You know?
So you had to do a kind of garden variety. What would you recommend for women who want to go into trades today?
Well, what I recommend is really asking for truth in advertising. You know, that we kind of have this image of you get this much per hour and think that you're going to really get that, you know, all year long and, you know, every year and really retire with that. So I think it's really good to ask. I think these are great careers. These are wonderful, you know, this wonderful work. It's just, you know, thrilling to kind of look at the skyline and, you know, you put up some of those buildings. But you have to say, you really ask, you know, the contractor or union, like, what have they been doing, or, you know, owner, like, what have they been doing to, you know, like, how are they your partner? And, you know, what's the real situation for women in that industry, and what are they doing to improve that, and how can you work together to do that? So I'd come in with a different attitude, I guess.
Susan Eisenberg, what about on the policy level? Is there movement now in the Obama administration? He's got a good Secretary of Labor. Is there any action on this?
Yeah, it's got wonderful people in the Department of Labor, and I think we're sort of waiting to see, to be honest. You know, so they're coming out. They're re-looking at, you know, these guidelines, and they're coming out with some draft resolutions in July, is what I understand. So I think that will be really important to kind of get that. I think not only guidelines and, you know, new monitoring, which, you know, could make something happen, but really I think I'm really hoping a recommitment to the rightness of this issue, to really standing out loud and saying, you know, women are capable and qualified to do this work, you know, which is what I think those 78 guidelines did. So I really hope they reiterate that.
Speaking of Susan Eisenberg, she's done some amazing work in the trades. She's a pioneer. We heard her read her poem called Pioneering. She's got a couple books out, We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction, and this poetry collection called Pioneering, Poems from the Construction Site, as well as Blind Spot. Let's talk a little bit about your poetry. Have you always written poetry?
When I was in elementary school, I remember we'd fill out in third grade, like, little, you know, things of what, you know, your interest, and then they told you what you fit, and, you know, I was either going to be a poet or a spy, which I thought was great, and I realized they're kind of not that different. And
how are they the same?
Well, you're sort of an observer. You're putting things together. You're, you know, putting odd things together, and I think an insider outsider in some way, and then I was really good fortune in the mid-70s to run into Denise Levertov and kind of get adopted by her. I just actually did wrote an essay for a book, Denise Levertov, The Poets After, about that mentorship.
But I've known a lot of women who have been hugely influenced by Denise Levertov.
So
was that out in Stanford, or where'd you meet her?
I was an audit student of hers at Tufts, when she was at Tufts in, you know, out in the Boston area. And in 75 to 76, she used to bring older students into her class to kind of round out the class. So I was 24, so I was like kind of this older life experience person, you know, which in retrospect was funny. But, you know, then I just stayed connected to her, and she wrote the foreword to my first chapbook. And what I didn't really realize until I would look back, you know, kind of through old things for this, to do this essay, how much she also really, you know, particularly supported my writing about work. So I had that training when I went, so I did that 75, 76, and then in 78 I went into the union apprenticeship. So that was an incredible tool for me to kind of keep going, because I could craft the experiences that were going on to me that were just very overwhelming. And I was sort of...
So would you write them at night or on the weekend?
Or like write it, you know, on a piece of sheetrock and stick it in your pack.
I saw in one of your poems.
Yeah, you know. And so you just write, you know, kind of take notes on the, you know, kind of like a line would come or phrase on the job. Yeah, yeah. You know, and there was actually a poem in the Pioneering later on, too, of a guy who fell on the job, you know, that, and, you know, and I could start writing that, on, you know, just, like sometimes it's just the... experiences were so intense. Yeah, so that was that really helped me. And then I you know, was really when the It's a Good Thing I'm Not Macho, that chapbook went out, it was what really made me realize what a common culture tradesmen had everywhere, because experiences that I thought were unique to, you know, our little five of us in Boston, electrician apprentices, was, you know, people from like other trades all over the country would write back like, that was my experience too. And that just opened my eyes. And that's really been another, you know, mentorship for me, really a kind of a conversation with the tradesman community that really, you know, kind of tells me when I've got it right or off or, you know. So that's been, I really have appreciated that.
Speaking with Susan Eisenberg, she mentioned her chapbook, It's a Good Thing I'm Not Macho, which is a title poem too. It's a great poem. We're at the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, and you talked a lot about people being injured on the job, and obviously this is the probably most famous, infamous, notorious case of workplace injuries in America. And so I think we'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to read that and maybe talk about it if we've got time.
Okay, so this is from Blindspot, and also, you know, part of this mixed media installation, On Equal Terms, that's touring and coming out to actually East Lansing, Michigan in January. Remembering the fire at Triangle Shirtwaist. Roberto in Milwaukee sizes me up, then sidles over sideways like a crab, asks if I've heard about the woman iron worker from Kenosha. It's no riddle. I read his eyes, pray he'll go mute. There are two versions to the story, he says, placing the bait. I bite, he tells. She was an apprentice, had two kids, fell from the steel and died. They say it shows women can't handle the business, but guys fall too. He waits. I ask for the other version, the one I see itching at the soft flesh beneath his shell. She asked for a safety harness. Foreman said she didn't need one. And Seattle. The buzz about the new line, women? Eager to impress means easy to fatigue. Send her up and down, up and down, up, down, up the pole. Soon her arms will just let go. Or unbuckle her belt, let her test her wings. When labor at century's start, bronze those bales of flaming shirtwaist girls cascading out the ninth floor windows of ash, was that not a covenant that the sky would stop dropping women?
That's Susan Eisenberg reading Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. There's still about 5,000 people who die every year in the workplace.
Mm-hmm,
and, and I think people just don't understand that, because it's not people flying out of windows in the hundreds anymore, but it's, you know, one here, one there, and all around the country.
Yeah.
What can be done about that?
Well, I think it's in some ways similar to the, we have affirmative action regulations, we have OSHA regulations, but we don't have the monitoring numbers, you know, so you really have to have the, you know, enforcement and the monitoring. You have to have the, and the same, similarly with discrimination in the workplace, with safety, you have to have the, you know, bigger penalties. So,
yeah, there's,
you know,
just seems
so
to be...
if there's not a consequence, you know, like the rules really don't, you know, people know that they can circumvent them.
That does seem to be the problem in the workplace. The employers get away with everything: bad, dangerous conditions, firing union people, breaking the labor laws. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I've really enjoyed getting to know your work, though, Susan Eisenberg, and I highly recommend it to anyone who's been listening. Her poetry includes Pioneering, Poems for the Construction Site, and Blind Spot, and also this nonfiction work, We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction. Susan Eisenberg, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.